Perry Mills, we're standing in the classroom that tradition tells us was the schoolroom in which Shakespeare learned his Latin and his Greek, and maybe learned the rudiments even of becoming a playwright. Last November, you and I persuaded 14 boys in this school to join us in a collaboration on a project to learn and rehearse and perform a very little known early modern play, John Marston's The Dutch Courtesan. And I want to revisit that project. I want you to tell us about that. A play that doesn't seem to have had any performance history professionally for at least 50 years. A play that is largely unread, has no exposure to the public, but it was a play in which boys would be playing young men, but also in which boys would be playing women.
Yeah.
The title role of the piece, The Dutch Courtesan, features a woman who is significantly betrayed. Now, could you just give us a synopsis of this play?
We wanted a play that was a boys' play, and that was already shifting away a little bit from the ground that I've been looking at before with you, which was primarily focusing on the boys playing women.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here it was going to be a boys' company,
yeah.
So they would play the women, as you say, but there was also a boy in the cast of this one.
Yeah.
So whatever age we decide that's going to be, that's quite interesting. And then, of course, they're playing men, some of them old men, and old women, of course, but also young men about town. And I think although the Dutch Courtesan, as you say, is the title, and she's certainly the one that everybody remembers because it's a remarkable character, I think, the real focal point is a couple of blokes, and they're young men about town. And when I was starting...
Significantly named Frevel?
Frevel and...
Malheureux.
When I was first reading it and thinking about it, it just leapt out at me that these are young undergraduates with all the kind of misbehaviour and so forth and attitudes towards money and women and so on that you'd expect of those kind of men and that kind of class.
Mm-hmm.
And then realising that it's set in London, but London was very much the kind of the Oxford or Cambridge at the same time because it was set in and around the Inns of Court. And Marston was at the Inns of Court himself, so with his legal background. So he was writing that kind of play. Kind of masculinity, a kind of, you know, these young men, it seemed to me, are probably 19, 20, 21 years old. They're on the cusp themselves and trying stuff out.
Yeah.
So that was interesting as well, to get boys who were practically that age and getting up to practically those same sorts of experiences and then having
don't
to play
them. Don't tell your mothers.
Which, you know, we think, oh, it's so difficult to play a Dutch courtesan because that's totally out of their experience. In some ways, it's just as difficult to play something that should be close to them because, of course, the thing that they naturally do is reproduce a kind of a series of tricks.
Okay. So at the centre of this play, we have Frevel, who's the lad.
That's right.
And his friend, who is...
Malheureux. Well, Frevel is Jack the lad, as you say, and a young man about town, and doesn't have any problem with enjoying life and partying. Malheureux is different. He's his friend, but his problem is that he's
buttoned up.
There's this kind of Puritanism about him. So he certainly thinks that brothels and that kind of relationship with women is totally unacceptable. And so they're a kind of Little and Large, or, you know, Lauren Hardy or something. They're different sides. And there is this relationship that clearly, when the players started, had been going on for some time between Frevel and the Dutch courtesan.
Okay.
This is his kind of pet prostitute that he goes to, and he goes and enjoys himself with her and then moves on. She falls in love with Frevel, and there's the real problem in the entire
And of course, when Frevel moves on, what he's moving on to or moving on from is the illicit relationship, and now moving into a licit relationship. So he's courting Bianca, the beautiful young woman who is going to bring him a marriage that is going to be recognized, is going to be solemnized,
status, blah, 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 money, and all of that sort of thing.
Malheureux is appalled that his friend consorts with a courtesan.
But the problem is, the moment he sees her,
he falls in love with her. Okay?
Love?
Well,
that's the problem.
Okay,
it's not so much love as just immediate lust, isn't it? That he's completely, and he's very embarrassed, and Marston makes it clear through some of the language, he's very embarrassed by his physical response
right.
to her.
Meanwhile, we have the secondary cast of characters who are doing the kind of low-life, japing,
the kind of
pulling
city,
tricks,
city comedy stuff.
kind of coney catching and so on. In terms of the female side of the play, we have the Dutch courtesan who has her sidekick, her bawd, Mary Foe. Then we have Bianca, the licit lady, and we have Bianca's sister, whose name is Crispinella.
Yeah.
Now, so we have a man's side of the play, we have a woman's side of the play, and these plays, these two plays that are in, you know, incendiary, you know, combustion with each other. Now, we start with this, you reading this play, seeing what's there as an opportunity for these young men, But it's also, of course, unlike Shakespeare, we have no cultural memory of the kind of lines that Marston is working on. It's all foreign to these lads when they pick up the text for the first time. And I remember it was in a very, very cold sixth form room in January when all the heating was on, where we all sat around a table. The boys had been assigned their parts. They had the scripts in front of them and they started reading.
Yeah.
And it was like molasses.
Yeah, it was
impenetrable, wasn't it?
It was in terrible physical conditions, as you say, because it was dark and cold. And also, Freeville, the lad playing Freeville, wasn't available. So one of the main parts wasn't there to read it. And they were confronted, as you say, by this really difficult text. It was difficult because there were lots of words they didn't recognise. Difficult because it was very, very much lawyer's jargon and all sorts of lawyer's jokes. And what we afterwards started to talk about, the way arguments develop for lawyers and examples are given forward and all that sort of thing. But also it was filthy. Completely filthy, and although the boys, once it had been carefully explained to them, could pick up on the filth, at first it just seemed rubbish, it literally nonsense. So that first rehearsal was in a sense terribly difficult, but two things came out of it. One, it really gave me a sense of this play is going to work. We know that part of it was that sense of excitement, because they were doing something for a variety of reasons that was different. We don't normally do plays in that way in school. The younger ones were really excited to be acting with some of the older ones who they've seen in other plays. We're going to London, we're going on tour. There's Professor Carol Rutter there.
But in
some
sense,
it's a naughty play. There were a series of things that really attracted them to that experience. And if it sounds like a lot of little boys, they are a lot of little boys, and that's what they got out of those early days, I think.
You made what I think of as a brilliant directorial choice early on in deciding not to try to put this play into period dress to set it in 1605, no matter what the language was doing, but to choose another visual regime, vocabulary. Tell me about that.
It was the way we made practically every decision, which was, you know, talking about it in rehearsal.
Ensemble.
Absolutely. We didn't make any firm decisions about period or costume or any of that for 2 or 3 weeks. First thing we did in every single rehearsal was sit down around a table and go through the text. And sometimes there was one rehearsal early on where we did 6 lines in an hour and a half.
Just
we
word did six bashing. Lines.
Word bashing, but what we did was get into the kind of humour of the play.
Right.
That rehearsal was the one where I was trying to explain an incredibly complex, silly joke. And that was when the boy said, oh, it's a mum joke. And they all nodded to each other. And that's where I had to start to learn what a mum joke is. And they gave me plenty of contemporary examples. And it was great. But it can only come from they know what they're doing. They know what they're supposed to be saying. And then they can
Okay, then out of that comes your design decision.
Yeah. Now, as I say, that wasn't 3 weeks into the process, probably. And we we probably performed after 5.5 weeks, so mm-hmm. it was quite late on. We knew it was going to be a bare stage, so it wasn't that we were going to have to yep. build a set, so that wasn't the complication. Complication was how we were going to get the costumes and props in time. Because we'd spent so much of our time in rehearsals relating what we were doing, what the text was suggesting to our own experiences yeah. and lives, yeah. it just seemed natural that it wasn't going to be in contemporary costume.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was then going to, okay, so if it's going to be modern dress, how modern?
Yes.
Were we going to go for today?
Yeah.
Or were we going to go for something in the recent past, but something that people could recognise? And that was where we ended up. And because it was pretty much because of the Oxbridge Young Men About Town, one member of the cast said in a rehearsal, well, why don't we do a kind of Jeeves and Wooster, P.G. Woodhouse
yeah.
kind
yeah.
of world for
yeah.
it.
Let's put it in blazers.
And then we thought, yeah, because everybody knows that kind of Jeeves yeah. and Wooster kind of world of young men behaving like silly twits, and then the people behind them trying to nick their pockets and so on, and they're prostitutes throughout the ages. So thinking, right, okay, which particular... So we decided it was the 1920s, did a quick bit of research, and then got the things together very quickly. When the boy who played Bianca, Johnny, was set up, he wore his sister's dress, which was very...
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that 1920s fashions are back in. So it was quite useful to get hold of the costume.
Read other people's wardrobes.
And also the hair, it was very, very easy because a couple of the girls who helped us with the production, it was just modelled on their own hair as well. So that was all very, very helpful. We didn't have to go with some of the characters into wigs or any of that stuff we started with talking
okay.
about the
Michael Wood. I want to talk about the three principal women, okay?
Yeah.
So we have Bianca, whom you've just described,
yeah.
she is the gorgeous,
yeah.
Approved,
yeah.
To be wooed
yeah.
and won and married woman, and it's played by Johnny
Clowes, and Johnny
who is one of the smallest
yeah.
of the company. He's only tiny,
yeah.
And this Bianca was to begin with set up in a window to be seen and to be adored.
Yes.
Okay, so we have that, and what was uncanny in performance was
yeah.
that Johnny, when people looked at him,
yes.
saw him mm. as a girl.
My
okay?
colleague who watched a late run, who's a drama teacher, sent me a note while it was going on saying, Johnny is a girl.
Yeah, okay.
And that's what
okay,
everyone
assumed. That's number one. Then we had the Dutch courtesan herself, played by Harry Davies.
Mm.
And Harry took on the dress almost of a flapper,
mm.
A long feather boa,
yeah.
more or less his own hair,
yeah.
slightly styled. But then had this extraordinary voice. Of course, she's the Dutch courtesan, and as Marston writes the script,
yeah.
he's writing it in a cod Dutch
yep.
kind of phonetics. Harry took that on and became a kind of what, Marlena Dietrich
yeah, yeah.
figure,
that was
or
very much one of the
Edith Piaf.
Yeah, that's
yeah,
exactly.
A low voice,
yeah.
a gravelly voice, a voice that had smoked far too many caps
that's right.
and cigarettes.
But you see, when he did the first song. Chose to do it as a kind of torch song, a blues torch song,
yeah.
which
because of course the courtesan is an entertainer.
Oh yeah,
and as Harry
yeah.
he played this part, he had a huge repertoire of things that he had to do.
Yeah.
You know, not just to come on and be the courtesan, but to have this extraordinary range of emotions
yeah.
from being in love with Freeville to discovering that Freeville was going to throw her
yeah.
over, and then doing an amazing aria of rage
mm.
and violence
yeah.
that then turned into a seduction of this other character,
yeah.
Malheureuse, in order to manipulate him
mm.
into killing Freeville in revenge.
Mm.
So we have that role,
yeah.
okay, and there is Harry in that place, yes. But the third role
yeah.
is Crispinella.
Yep.
And Crispinella is Bianca's sister.
Very forceful.
She's the Beatrice character
yeah.
out of Much Ado. She's
yeah.
the one who challenges male opinions and male fantasies
mm.
and male conventions. She's the one who kind of takes on the business of being female in a man's world. So what
yeah.
decisions did you make about her?
Well, it's why I wanted to get to Act 3, Scene 1. Because she
yeah.
doesn't appear till Act 3, Scene 1. And as the play develops, Her character becomes much more important, and a subplot between a character we haven't mentioned yet called Tisifu. She and Tisifu, Crispinella and Tisifu, get together and end up getting married. And that seems to be the one that with the relationship we're supposed to look at and think, that's good, because these two would spark off each other.
So it's Kate and Petruchio, yeah, Beatrice and Benedict.
Absolutely, okay. And I very much wanted to get to Crispinella, because she introduces, as you've implied, something different. Well, I think what's interesting, if you go through the reactions of the audience to the three of them, Johnny is 12. And looks angelic, he's blonde hair, big round eyes. And so putting him in his sister's dress with a little demure cardigan on and nicely made up through the picture frame, the audience did, as you say, all think that is a girl and gasped. Mm-hmm. It was better, I think, that he was 12 than he was 17. To play that part. I think it fitted in with that image of purity and innocence, and the way that it developed was safer with a 12-year-old. Mm-hmm. Something different was going on. You couldn't have had a 12-year-old, I think, play the Dutch courtesan. And Harry is 16, and he was able to inhabit it in a different way. In part, what we did, of course, was make use of the stereotype of the exotic, erotic, prostitute, heavily made up, bare arms, using the boa. And you said she's an entertainer in the text. She plays the lute for that first song. So her hands would be engaged playing the lute. Harry doesn't play the guitar, so we had another lad play the guitar to accompany him. But of course that left his hands free, and you will remember that he manipulated Malora and really enjoyed the flirtatious game.
Yeah.
For the benefit of Freeville, it was a kind of game she was playing. So there was all of that. We used that stereotype, and then, of course, the audience eventually discovered something else. And what they were, there were shrieks of laughter in the performance, particularly here, when people recognised Harry dressed up like that, which was almost uncontrollable. And then they controlled it. And then they really controlled the audience. And the silences.
Well, I mean, what was going on there was that the audience thought that they were seeing a comedy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And what we discover is that the play is the tragedy of the Dutch courtesan. And there is a moment when, out of that exchange of rejection, where the Dutch courtesan is hanging on to Freeville and wanting his ring, Freeville pushes her, and then in your production, violently hit her, so she sprawled onto the floor, at which point the audience went very, very silent.
And so they learned other things, having, you know, if you like, reacted to the woman first of all as a stereotype, and then she's a much more rich
character.
So it pulled
the ground up from the audience.
And of course, one of the things that we discovered is that two lads who are 17 and 16, respectively, can push and hit each other in a way that a boy cannot hit a girl, wouldn't it? You know, it'd be something different on stage if it was with a girl.
Or indeed, that he could not have had that relationship with Johnny.
Absolutely, because
they were matched. Because physically, in terms of age and maturity, they were matched. They could play with each other with a kind of audacity and kind of intensity that was not going to be possible elsewhere.
The real point of that, of course, was the kissing.
Yeah,
and we did have
I want to go there in a moment. But tell us about Crispinella.
Right, now we're getting to Crispinella, and it seemed to me, this was quite late on, that Crispinella, being this forceful blue stocking who was very clever with language, as witty as the men and wittier, as filthy as the men and filthier, and enjoyed not just provoking the men, but enjoyed provoking her own sister as well, who was very much a free spirit. And it just seemed to me, come on, if we're talking 1920s, the obvious thing is to have her dressed as a man. That was her statement. So she was in a suit, she had a cigarette in a long holder, she had a monocle that she would use, and you know, it was a challenge to people who met her. And it was a challenge to the audience.
Jamie
Hyten,
Who played Crispinella.
Yeah.
And then the audience had a kind of a double take.
Yeah.
Because they're seeing this boy playing a woman, but dressed as a man.
Which threw a number of people, and it was supposed to be confusing.
It was supposed to be disconcerting. In the way that women wearing trousers should have been disconcerting.
And in the way that this play is disconcerting. Yeah. Constantly, wherever you think you know where you are, Marston pulls the rug from under you. And that was probably the most explicit and obvious example. And several people said, even at the end, what was going on there? Yeah. And then when you sort of nudge them in that direction, then everybody said, oh yeah, yeah. So I think it's vindicated as a kind of design decision.
Yes.
And certainly Jamie really enjoyed it because it allowed him a kind of freedom that yeah. he probably wouldn't have had if he was dressed in a
but
dress.
It's another way of testing the conventions and the mores
yeah.
and the expectations
yeah.
of everybody who is in the play,
yeah. Yeah.
but also
yeah.
everybody who's in the audience. Now, I wonder if you can just talk about some of the real challenges to the rehearsal and performance.
Yeah.
There's a point in the scene between the first scene between the Dutch courtesan and Frivel in which she has to kiss him.
Yeah, yeah, and it, I mean, there are three kisses explicitly written in the text as stage directions,
yeah.
and then there are other opportunities to kiss if we wanted to. We didn't prepare for it, just got to the bit. Now, these two kiss each other in the text clearly, fervently, and
passionately,
lustfully.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Passionately. You say passion, I say love. It's funny.
But
they,
I'm such a romantic.
Yeah, they absolutely went for it. To the extent that open mouths and everything. Now, this caused consternation in the rehearsal. Partly for the two boys, because when they came apart, there was a stagger. Everybody else who was, you know, this ensemble cast, suddenly it was something different. The little boys, well, the one who was playing Bianca, Johnny, thought for a minute, this is going to happen to me later, and was terrified. Another one became very interested in his rugby magazine. One of the women in the room, who was helping as stage manager, used to go out with Oliver, so she thought it was incredibly funny what was going on.
Yeah.
There were real reactions. We talked about it, of course, afterwards as a kind of laugh and so on, and that was great, and they were happy with it, not a problem. But that evening, Oliver emailed me about it because I'd asked them to keep a record, and he was already getting very excited about the first performance because he wanted to know how an audience would react to that kiss because
mm-hmm.
they knew they had something kind of electric there. Now, there was a real challenge for expectation and convention and so on. We
okay.
couldn't do it in another way.
Well, you didn't, but in performance, you didn't duck it.
No.
The Dutch courtesan had on heavy red lipstick.
Yeah.
And the kiss was not just a kiss. The kiss became almost a brand across
yeah.
the face
yeah.
because there was the lipstick that was smeared across Frivel's face. And he was then, for the rest of the scene, marked as having
absolutely
been in this
right.
relationship with the Dutch courtesan.
Yeah.
And I remember with the audience, there being a kind of a gasp when that happened. Okay, so there's the kiss, there's the physical sexuality that's going on, and the erotic exchange, the erotic charge that's being presented. Okay, what about the violence in the play?
Yeah, as I've said, if you've got boys working on stage together, you don't ever want to do anything that's dangerous. Of course, they can't get hurt. But they can explore their physicality more. There was one moment of extreme violence, which you've already described, where Frivel casts aside very, very violently the Dutch courtesan, Frankestrina, and she falls to the floor and then spends quite a long time getting herself back up and getting her dignity back. It had to be that violent to create the response. And it did. Again, I don't think.
But there was also wonderfully. There was much more violence in the show that would be come under the heading of just roustabout.
Oh yes, that.
So you opened the show
yeah.
by doing well. The opening of
they
the play
on,
is a long narrative
yeah.
device.
Yeah.
And what you decided to do was not just have the speech. But while Frivel is telling this long, complicated tale about some bowls that got stolen and somebody was blind in a room
yeah,
and a this
yeah.
and a that and so on, what your boys did was to play, to mime yeah. the whole thing and to show us the
yeah.
events in physical theatre.
Yeah, yeah. You know, It's what you find in a lot of plays, isn't it? You know, we'll help you to find out who these characters are by pointing these things up.
Yeah.
But it's what you find with groups of boys standing around, and I have no doubt groups of girls as well. But groups of boys, when they're trying to tell you a really good story about what happened on Saturday night, they'll be up and about and doing the bits and engaging with it. So that's how we did it. So it did make it more clear to the audience, because it was very difficult text. But the great thing is people didn't notice it was difficult, I don't think, because they were laughing at the sheer joie de vivre of these kids who were on each other's shoulders, who were doing somersaults, who were leaping and wrapping their legs around each other's waists.
With horns and balloons and party hats and so on.
And it was that sense of play that ran through the production and the rehearsal process. Because, as I've said to you on many occasions, they are just a group of boys.
My role in the theatre is audience. I see myself as a kind of professional spectator. And what I bring to the theatre is my observation. I help to make the show because I'm there, the person out there in front. And I know that having participated in this project across the year, that what I know what I got out of it. And it was that kind of visible excitement of seeing performed at a real level of engagement and seriousness, having tested it, the business of the cross-dressing, of seeing the boys becoming women under the pressure of emotion.
Do you think we were at any point camp?
No, not at all. And that was what was wonderful about it.
We were trying to avoid that.
But that was because it seems to me that comes out of your rehearsal process of occupying the language and doing exactly what the language is asking you to do. So I know what I got out of it.
Yeah.
What did the boys get out of it?
You know, any time you do a play, you're going to learn things. They learnt a tremendous amount. I mean, they learnt an awful lot about being a company, which was probably the most important thing. They learnt a great deal about playing different spaces. Mm-hmm. The first time they performed it in front of an audience was at your Capital Centre, a sort of a blank box with audience on three sides. Then they performed here in Big School in a different atmosphere and a very different set up to the stage, then down to a proscenium arch theatre, then to a sort of indoor Elizabethan thrust stage.
Yep.
So they learnt a very great deal about performance spaces. They learnt an enormous amount about the way you take on difficult text. All of them really appreciated, they're not just telling me that, really appreciated the rehearsal process and unpicking what this stuff means, and then finding ways of making it live and making it come alive and communicate with people. So that gave them huge confidence, I know, to the other projects they've moved on to. They learnt a huge amount about the relationship between men and women, inhabiting those roles. Harry, who played the courtesan, it altered his attitude and his ideas about women and about prostitutes and about attitudes towards prostitution, both male and female, and so on. So there's those kind of explicit ones. And he wasn't the only member of the cast. Several of them, with Matt Cameron, said at one point in a rehearsal to Harry as the courtesan, "I feel really sorry for you." So they learned an enormous amount about those kind of difficult relationships. And I think I'd come back to this importance of play. They did have a thoroughly good time, even down to messing about backstage at the Globe just before going on, to such an extent that one of the very little boys was nearly injured, and then they had to sort of apologise and calm down and remember, but then get on and do the show. And I think that they did sort out the way that it's important to play, and then put play away in its box and get on with the job of work and do the job of work.
Because you know that we have a crisis, a continuing crisis in schools about what boys learn
and how
they learn
and
if it's possible to teach emotional literacy to young men and where they get that. I mean, is this the kind of project that you think not to recruit it to pedagogy and that kind of?
No.
But is this a place where emotional is that what those does text were doing, do you think, on the original school's curriculum in Shakespeare's days?
Well, no. I mean, I think some of those texts that we explored a few years ago, that's definitely the case. Yeah. And I think that doing a play brings about those kinds of results. Yeah. If it's done in the right spirit, I would say.
I mean, what struck me in watching them was that there were boys who were not just becoming women, there were boys who were seriously thinking about the consequences of being male.
And
so it wasn't just Matt saying to the courtesan, I'm feeling sorry for you. I think it was the range of boys who were thinking, what are the implications of my behaviors, and where is that going to go? And the hypocrisy that is acculturated, that is perfectly acceptable in that play about, you know, throwing over the woman you use in order to have the approved marriage with the woman, and then Crispinella in the center being a kind of adjudicator and a questioner about these mores. But those men occupying that text were learning, it seems to me, something about being male.
That's absolutely right, and it ain't easy. that's absolutely right. I mean, the guy playing Freeville, Oliver, texted me, emailed me at one point and said, how difficult for me as a 17-year-old lad having to think about sex all the time, as a joke. On the other hand, he was the first one to say that Freeville behaves appallingly at these moments. Yeah. I think it is, it is a wonderfully educational experience. But in the rich way. Because the moment you tie it in with kind of national curriculum and targets, of course, it dwindles, because it's that lightness. You learn these things whilst thinking of something else, don't you?
Yeah.
And that's exactly the value. You know, I do still have a lot of thinking to do about the sex in this play.
Yes.
In the sense that we've talked about the kissing. And I still don't know whether it was right for them to kiss in that way. It was right in terms of the show, because it created the response. But I'm not certain that I know what I mean by it, whether it was right. But is that what would have happened on the Jacobean stage? Would they have kissed in those ways? I mean, you know much better than I about the worries, the concerns that people had writing at the time. About the fact that these boys will be corrupted, these men who watch these boys will be corrupted, and they'll engage in all sorts of practices. Is that the case?
Mm-hmm.
The experience that we had was relaxed and playful, and people were able to cope with it and go away. But how did people see them in the audiences that we had?
Yeah.
It was absolutely clear to some members of the audience, because they told me, that the erotic power of adolescent boys, whether they're dressed as boys or girls, came across in the performance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, where does that go? What happens there? Is that just flying around the room
we put it up on up? Is the theatre, is the early modern theatre, is the Jacobean theatre, one of those places where culture learns to do sex?
Yeah.
And learns to do sex well? Maybe learns to do sex very badly, learns to do sex disastrously, learns to do sex at a very, very high emotional and human cost.
Yeah.
But this project isn't over, is it?
No.
We're going further. We're continuing in the next stage next year, choosing perhaps another play, which is going to be your baby, that you will once again put together. A group of young men who are willing to get on board, to take the risk, to trust, to bash the words, to put on the clothes, to think across, and to continue this looking at the early modern text as something that they want to play with. Mm. So we look forward to this, and I wanted to thank you very, very much for having this conversation with me today.
Thank you for thanking me, Carol, but thank you very much.